And welcome back to the Livingston Parish News Weekly Show, a podcast brought to you by the Livingston Parish News. My name is McHugh David, publisher and editor of the news, and today we're joined by somebody who, as I was just telling him before I hit record, I'm excited about this one. Lots to talk about today. And those of you who are listening and those of you who are watching, as he introduces himself, you'll understand why there's going to be plenty to talk about. So good morning, sir. Thanks for taking the time. If you'll go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, thank you, McHugh, for having us here this morning. It's my pleasure to be here and try to bring some brevity and lightness to the topics that we'll be discussing. My name is J. Rogers Pope. I am a resident of Livingston Parish, have been since 1956.
Okay.
So I've been here most of my life, went to school here, done everything you could do in this thing. I guess where I'm going with that is that I've been in a lot of places, done a lot of things. If you'd like to hear a little bit about where I have done, I'll be glad to share that with you. I started out as a student at Dunn Springs High School, graduated from Dunn Springs High School, went to Southeastern, graduated, get master's plus 30 degree, started teaching at Livingston Parish. Taught in elementary, middle school, and high school. Moved on to administration, got into administration. I was a principal at an elementary school, middle school, and high school. Started that career in Walker. First 12 years I was there, I was in Walker, and then I came to Dunham Springs, opened a school in Dunham Springs. After that, I also served as an assistant principal at Walker High School as well as principal at Walker High School. I moved to the central office as assistant superintendent, where I had multiple jobs. Human resources was the biggest one. We took care of human resources. That time, it was a smaller operation than it is today because of the sheer numbers. We saw our growth go from 12,000 to 20,000 in the 14 years that I was there. After I became superintendent in 1987, and I stayed there to 2001, where I retired. After retiring from the superintendency, I went and worked a little bit with a nonprofit organization, the Louisiana Association of School Executives. And then the House of Representatives seat opened in 2006. In 2007, had a little group of people come and ask me to consider running. Had never thought about it, quite frankly. And this was the seat opened up, quite frankly, 3 days before qualifying.
And not a whole lot of warning.
Not a lot of warning. And on a Friday when we found out that it was open, I had a couple of guys come to me, think about it. My wife and I talked about it. We prayed about it. We thought about it. And on Tuesday, we decided we were not going to do this. On Wednesday morning, she got up. My wife says, "We can do this." I said, "Look, we have no money. We have no plans. Qualifying ends today." But anyway, to make a long story short, we went and qualified, and there was five people in that race. And history will tell you that it was the nicest, the cleanest, the best race that we have on a political side in Livingston Parish for a long time, maybe even forever. Because everybody was genuine, interested in the position. It was a clean, it was just one that you would like to be a part of, which sure. I enjoyed that.
Sure.
But anyway, I had the fortune of being elected in 2007, which I took over 2008. I was reelected without opposition in 2011, 2012 took over. Again, in 2015, I was reelected without opposition. And then in 2016-17, after being term limited from the House of Representatives after 12 years, I wanted to see what the Senate was like. And I did run for Senate in 2019. In 2020, I was elected the state senator from this area. Served there, and am now presently the senator in that area, and will be until December, which I have chosen not to run again. And so basically that's my history. I'm sorry I was so long-winded, but when you're old and you've deceived, you know, like I am, you've done a lot of things. And I will say this, the people in this parish has been really gracious and good to me and my family, and I wanted to give something back. For almost 60 years, I've been in this public service and have enjoyed every minute of it, and I don't know of a day I'd go back and change, quite frankly.
And that's quite a statement from somebody who's got, as I listen to you sort of lay that all out, well near 60 years.
Almost 60.
Of public service. So to have that many and to say, you know, I don't feel like I have any regrets, that's quite a statement. So I want to go back before we kind of get into present day, what's going on at the moment. I do want to go back and start with, you know, I didn't know you actually started as a student. So when you're a student and you're looking around at school, you were in the Denham School District. Did you ever think, not even like, am I going to go through this whole pipeline of public service? Did you ever even really think about being a teacher while you were in school?
Yes. I knew when I was in the fifth grade that I wanted to be a teacher. And that was because I had a teacher that encouraged me to do some things. And I enjoyed, I learned a lot from her. Her name was Hilda Smith, of course, deceased now. And that was in the state of Tennessee. But that's when I knew that I was going to be, and it was a struggle, quite frankly. My parents were educated people, self-educated, had no formal education. I had six siblings, three brothers and three sisters.
Packed house.
So you were pretty much on your own. And it was a struggle, but I knew that I was going to do it. And I guess that's where we are. I knew I wanted to be, though, and that's why I trained myself in high school, knowing that I was involved in athletics, and that's what I wanted to be.
So, and you just brought it up. I do believe you are a member of the Denham Springs Hall of Fame, correct?
That is correct.
And so you also had, considering your circumstances, you had both a storied academic and athletic career. But I wanted to ask you a specific question because you just brought up, you had six siblings, self-educated parents who were, you know, I'm sure working.
Work
you know,
parents,
I'm,
yes.
You know, that's a busy household. I'm sure it's an expensive household. You know, I don't think that ever changes. You know, if you've got a bunch of kids, you go to work.
Yep.
So through all that, you clearly became self-motivated, tenacious. Tell us a little bit about how that carried forward through your career. You don't have to be specific at points, but just sort of an overall, like, did you continue to draw back from those experiences?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you have that many in the household, a small house, not a lot of revenue, a lot of, you know, whatever. My dad was a construction worker, and people that are in that business knows what it was like. At that time, it was, you know, strong unions, and he was a union person at that time. Anyway, we got through it, and we had a loving family. We really did. We had a supportive family. Quite frankly, though, they never were able to encourage me a whole lot to go on and further my education after high school. That's something I chose to do, and they supported that, but I was pretty much on my own, you know. Enjoyed that. My siblings, they were very supportive. I have three sisters, three brothers. Two of my brothers are now deceased, younger brothers. I'm a third in the pecking order. I have two older sisters, and then I'm the older male. But my two brothers next to me are now deceased, and I have one younger brother that was also in the school system in this parish, Randy.
Right. So, you know, we just talked about you were going to do it.
I was
right?
going to do it.
You decided you were going to do it.
I was going to do it.
And you said you had the support, but it wasn't quite, you know, what you were expecting maybe. But as you went on to get, you know, your postgraduate degree and master's, what was kind of your feeling as you were going through that? Because, I mean, we all know school can be ruthless at times. There are ups, there are downs. How did you keep moving through that?
Well, just by osmosis, I guess. I just wanted to teach, and I enjoyed teaching. And in fact, I think in my later life, I may come back and teach a year just to finish out a career that I've enjoyed so much.
There you go.
That isn't the plans, quite frankly.
Oh, okay.
But we were pretty well self-motivated. I have to say that, and I don't want to sound from an ego standpoint, but we had to be, and we were determined to succeed. I enjoyed teaching, and I enjoyed kids. Was it a challenge? Was whatever. I can tell you though that I never, and this is honest God's truth, I never had a day that I went to school that I had ill feelings about. I always enjoyed it.
Sure.
Never had a job, I had a position.
So, and I want to ask you a question real quick because you just brought it up because we were going to now transition. Okay, so obviously you got your master's, you got into teaching. If you go, you have taught, at least at the time, you taught every grade level that was available. You said you're going back. Where do you want to go back?
I want to go back to the middle school.
Okay, the junior high. All right.
I want to go back to the middle school and because those are the kids that wake up as babies one day and grown-ups the next day, and it's just a whole different world. And they need a lot of guidance, a lot of instruction. I don't know if I can give that to them. I think I can. I think I have something to offer. Always enjoyed that age group.
Now, you are a former principal of Southside, correct?
Southside, yes. Junior high school.
Buckening.
Yes. Yep.
And we'll get to that in a second because, okay, of course, I want to ask you about, the new school, that behemoth. But first, let's start with the beginning of your teacher career. You get your master's. Where'd you land?
I landed the fourth grade at Walker Elementary School. Stayed there a year. Then I moved over and was asked to go to the middle school, the junior high school, which was part of Walker High School at that time, and start an athletic program, which they didn't have a sports program, basketball, football. And so I went over there and stayed there a year. The principal, who happened to be the girls' basketball coach at Walker High School at that time, he was a basketball coach, and the principal left, and he became the principal, so they asked me to come over and coach girls' basketball, which, 2 years after being in school, the third year I'm going to Walker High School to coach girls' basketball. That was another challenge, but one that I accepted and one that ended up to be one of the highlights of my career, quite frankly.
Well, and I was going to ask, what did you learn from that experience?
Oh, it was just a different world. I'd played basketball quite successfully in high schools and also a little bit in college and independent ball and that kind of thing. But I'd never, and my wife was a basketball player. We were high school sweethearts.
Sure.
But other than that, I didn't know a lot about it. But it was a great challenge. And I will brag a little bit on this one.
Okay.
I am very, very, we had some great kids. I coached girls basketball at Walker High School, going there, and then I stayed there for 6 years. In 6 years, we won 3 state championships, got beat in the semifinals 1 year and the quarterfinals 2 years. We won 170-something basketball games and lost 17. We had an 88-game winning streak at one time, and that's all historical. I mean, these are not made up numbers. These are things that research can tell you. But it wasn't anything that I was doing. We just had great kids. We had really good athletes, but they were better people and hard workers. And they had the dedication that it took. And that's what inspired me to go on and do other things as well.
So, kind of a you gave them something, they gave you something.
Exactly.
Did, through that coaching, you brought up something, you said they were better people and they worked hard. Do you feel like your experience as a student and early teacher drawing from, I asked you already, did you draw back from that sort of self-motivation and guidance? Do you feel like you imparted some of that on them?
Oh, absolutely. We had an understanding. We're going to do this. We're going to do it right, and we're going to play by the rules. And these are the game. This is what we're going to do. and you can live that way, or we can do something else. They chose to live that way. And they were very dedicated, very loyal. And we'll have to tell you that whatever we ask them to do, run through a wall, they try to run through the wall. but it was something that I had learned by not just participating, but watching and being associated with my high school coach, who instilled those things in me.
Sure. So not only did you take from your own experiences, but some of the things that you were taught.
Absolutely.
As an athlete.
Absolutely.
So I, you know, got to mold a new generation as they, you know, moved.
Well, they've all moved on and are very successful today doing different things, and we still stay in touch.
Sure. And, you know, a quick question, you know, for some current parents who might be listening to this, is it your belief, as you were both a student athlete and mostly engaged, well, not mostly, but you engaged a lot with student athletes, is it your belief that, you know, there is a lot to be learned from being a student athlete, to be gained?
Absolutely. I think it's very, very important. I think athletics has a tremendous amount of respect in place to help mold kids, you know. It's not for everybody. I mean, there's other activities, you know, extracurricular activities. I think it's very important for people, their students, to get involved in something, though, extracurricular. It can be band, it can be, you know, athletics, it can be, you pick one.
Sure.
But clubs, but they got to be involved in something to have the interest in whatever. I would like to go back and clear something up. I just didn't coach girls basketball, though. I was also coaching football at the same time. We helped with that for 12 years at Walker High School. Very, very instrumental in helping mold me as well. Started a baseball program. We have some good male athletes that I learned a lot from, and so I don't want to leave those people out either.
Sure, absolutely. So a multi-sport coach.
Multi-sport, yes.
But as we move away from Walker Junior High, where you became, I believe his name was Jim Calhoun, the coach at UConn that had those huge winning streaks. So with girls basketball. So you moved on from there. Where did you land next?
I was went over to, after that, stayed and coached, got out of basketball, coached boys basketball for a couple of years, but, you know, just moved on, became assistant principal at Walker High School under a mentor of mine. Mr. Jerry Morgan was a principal. I'd like to mention him because he was very much a mentor of mine to help me in the area of administration to prepare me, help prepare me for that. I had coached with him at Walker High School as well, so we were good friends. Wish him well today. He's not doing well, but I do wish him well. But anyway, that's where that started.
Okay, and so you ended up as assistant principal.
I left there as assistant principal, and then. Went on down to the Walker Junior High School as a principal.
Okay, so that's where you made your jump.
I made a jump. I take that back. I was a principal at the elementary school before, and then I went to be the assistant principal at Walker High School. Then I went to the middle school as a principal, and I went back to the high school as a principal. And then I came to Southside Junior High School in 1979 to open a new school.
Gotcha. Okay, so a lot of bouncing around in Walker.
Well, I was trying to find a place to land. I don't think I could find a place that really suited me.
Sure. So then you end up a buck, I guess you can say. So you help open this school. You know, you're coming in as a new administrator, a new school. What did it feel like to open the door?
It's an amazing thing, and I wish that everybody that's in administration will have the opportunity to open a new school. Major, major challenges to start it. You have to start and do everything. I mean, you got to get your faculty, you got to get your staff. It was overwhelming. We opened a school that was only 90% or less complete. It's a true story. Mike Harris, who was my assistant principal when we opened that school in 79, he and I worked out of my house for a whole summer trying to interview people. And you think about people when you call and ask them for an interview. Well, we were going to do this. Well, you can come to my house.
Right.
It was not always pleasant.
No, I can imagine. Yeah. Wait, I don't want to come to your house.
Yeah. It was quite a challenge, but my wife understood. She was always around, and but it worked. It worked. But then we got on, and as far as putting it together, it took us a while. But we, I think, ended up being one of the premier middle schools in this parish.
And what is an experience from Southside that you have taken with you?
Oh, I think that the kids, not just those kids, but I think it all kids, they want somebody to tell them what the rules are and be consistent in what those rules are. If you cross the line, this happens. If you don't cross the line, this is going to happen. But be consistent with it. They want somebody to let them know. They just want direction. And I think more so today than ever before, that not only do they want it, stepping out on the limb a little bit, I think maybe in some places they need it.
Sure.
Without a doubt.
Sure.
And I think that's one thing. There's a standing joke, and I'll go ahead and tell this standing joke.
No, that, please do.
When we would have an event with all the student body, when they went in the gym, there was no talking, no nothing, until we give them permission. That was quite a feat. It took us a few times to get in and out, but we managed that because I wanted the people that were coming in that we had invited in to be able to, and the kids respected that.
Sure.
They knew when they come in that they was to be. We had a pep rally, then we had a good time at a pep rally.
Sure. So, but I mean, you explain to them, this is what's going to happen.
This is what's going to happen.
And this is what's going to happen if you don't.
That's it.
So, how many years were you at Southside?
6 years. I was 6 years principal there before I went to the central office. I was asked to go out to the central office, went out there as assistant superintendent, served in that capacity for a little over a year and a half, I guess. And really went out as a human resources director. Personnel, if you will, stayed there, and then took on some other jobs as well. You know, the only one that I never really had directly was transportation, which was probably a good thing. But did just about everything that you could do because we were a small operation at that time. You know, we had 12,000 students when I started. And then took over as superintendent in 87. I went there in 85 and took over in 87 as superintendent. Stayed as school superintendent for 14 years. Retired in 2001 and then got into a career of nonprofit just to stay in the, it was a nonprofit educational opportunity to stay in what I really wanted to be about until the election came about in the House of Representatives, and we talked a little bit about that. And
we're going to talk more about that in a minute. I want to back up.
Sure.
I want to back up to this when you were a superintendent.
Okay.
You know, we hashed out some of these details before we got started, but you know, you come in 87, you're on the heels of the oil bust, and it's a tough time, especially in Louisiana. But you're looking around at your system. As you come in as its leader and you're saying there has to be some changes, and you worked with your initial board to make some of those changes. Tell us about some of the things you were after before we talk about some of the headlines that started popping up in the early 90s.
Well, and I have the utmost respect for the former superintendent. I took his place, Mr. Carroll Leggett, great guy. He left the world at an early age. Unfortunately, God called him home. Had a heart attack mowing his yard shortly after he had retired, and I took his place. But to say that once we took over, you know, we didn't need a lot of changes because things were going well. But as you had said, we were in an oil bust. Things were tough. School district had no money at that time, and this is the time when you had to go to the big house in Baton Rouge and get on your knees and kiss somebody's ring if you wanted a little money. And quite frankly, and this was no disrespect on the people that we had to represent us at that time, we just didn't have a large representation. So if you weren't from Jefferson Parish or Orleans Parish or Caddo Parish, you know,
yeah,
you were way in line to get in that, to kiss that ring.
Right.
So we had a board that I can tell you that was very, very proactive in trying to not only make changes, but make changes for the better. And they allowed us to do some things with their blessing that I think changed the system and to make it what it is today, or help make it what it is today. The foundation was there. I think we just built on it. We knew that we had to do something to recruit a better group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Right, frankly, we wanted to increase the quality of people we had. We had good people, but we needed more people, and we needed quality of people. But we had to pay them. So we started with the board's blessings. We started trying to pay our people a little bit better and was very successful in that. Very successful in recruiting people at that time. And I think it elevated not just the clientele that we had, but also the climate that we had, but it also elevated the academics that we had going on within the school. And that was what it was all about.
Sure. And one of the things that I was bringing up was a headline from 1991. You know, we have it in our lobby here at the paper. That said, teacher pay surpasses Baton Rouge, or BR is what it says specifically. Because, you know, back then you had to make sure the headline fit. It's not like the internet today where it's like, here's a headline that gives you pretty much the gist of the story. But y'all had finally been able to elevate to one of the highest pay scales in the Nine Parish area. As you and I have talked about, you know, you can do that one day, and the next day EBR could have done something different. But it was a milestone.
It was a milestone for us, yes. Because at that time, Livingston Parish was looked at as a little podunk rule,
yeah,
non-factor. And I think, you know, with the people that we had, the people we were able to work with, our school, you know, and we had good schools. I can tell you, and I think change the dynamics. And if you look around now, we're what, the eighth and ninth largest school, largest parish in the state now.
Oh yeah, we are the second fastest growing parish.
Absolutely,
in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And we have, I believe, the school system is fifth.
Fifth. That's correct.
Now, if you threw, Zachary's its own system. Central's its own system, so I don't want to say the numbers are skewed, but
they
have
are.
Some individual systems that have large schools. I mean, they're 5A schools, but with all the schools together, it's the fifth largest in the state. And you know that's something that's being worked through right now, because from about that point up until Katrina, you had pretty steady growth.
We did.
After Katrina, it was exponential. I remember after the flood, there was a lot of debate about the change in population because of the flood, and I had decided to kind of go back and pull from census data and headlines, you know, the growth of the parish. And it's very interesting, very linear from that time until about 2005, and then from 2005 to 2015, it's exponential. It hits
Absolutely.
An exponential curve. It's
Absolutely.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So anyway, you kind of score some early victories, kind of lay some groundwork for a pretty steady tenure.
We did.
As superintendent. And in 2001, you said you retired.
That's correct.
So tell next you get into, and I'm going to have to stand up and reset the camera here, but I'm going to let you keep talking on this question. You said that you had started working for a nonprofit for school administrators, correct?
That is correct.
So I think that's kind of a gap for a lot of people. They don't know that you did that. So can you get into detail on what you were doing during that time?
Well, it was called the Louisiana Association of School Executives. It was a nonprofit made up of school administrators statewide. That was consisted of superintendents, principals, assistant principals, central office employees, non-teachers. Was an organization that was started in 1980, 1978. And it's still in existence. And truth be known, I'm still running the organization today. We are in the process, though, of having dissolution. In 2025, that organization will be dissolved.
Okay.
And the dynamics have changed of what we were offering and what we were trying to do. And you had asked the question, part of the question was what we did. We were very instrumental in putting on workshops, conferences. We offered technical services, legal services. Even today, we do those things for that group of people, which we at one time, I guess at the highest number, we had about 2,200 people statewide. Now we got about 1,200. And that's one of the reasons that people are getting their information other ways, through internet, and I have a board to work with, and we've chosen to just dissolve the organization. And we took a 3-year dissolution process. But it was good for those 40-something years it was in existence. Only had two directors, one prior to me, and then I've been there for 20-something years being the director of that organization. But it was just a part-time gig as well, and that's why they allowed me and encouraged me, quite frankly, to help me get into, the political realm, because we could see some benefits there being instead of outside the rail, on the inside of the rail. And it's not only served our organization, but I think it's served me, and it's served the educational community statewide by me and being in the House of Representatives and the Senate. I think we've made some inroads and done some good with that.
Sure. So let's roll into that. You've already discussed part of it, at least, and that was the time leading up to it. 3 days before, some folks showed up at your house, said, "Hey, we'd love for you to run." You thought about it. No. Then you woke up the last day of qualifying. Your wife said, "Maybe we should give this a shot." So I actually want to start with, because it's appropriate for the current time frame, what was it like? Because you made a statement, which is, I know there's a lot of talk about these kinds of things, which would be money in politics. But that was one of the first things you brought up with your wife is, "I don't know if we can do this. We don't have any money." Mm-hmm. So You go up to the courthouse, you sign your name, you qualify, you know you're in the race with four other people. It turns out to be a very clean and good race, but what was it like, you finish having the conversation with your wife, you go and you qualify, and then you come home and, I would imagine, but you can tell me if I'm right, you have a now what moment.
That's where we are. But one of the guys that had come and encouraged me to run also had offered his help if, in fact, we would do this. And he happened to be, Larry Kinlaw, I'll call his name, who lives over in the Willows. He had run some campaigns before. He had worked in the Treen administration when he was the governor. He had worked with David Bitter. He had worked with others. He at one time was the, and I'm a Republican. I don't have a problem saying that. And he was the director of the Republican Party in Louisiana at one time, so he knew a little bit about what was expected, and he sort of spearheaded our campaign. He and my wife.
Okay.
She ran the meeting. He told her what to do, how to do. She organized it, and Mr. Pope was out on the road, trying to raise votes and get a few dollars here and there. She allowed me to go and loan ourselves some money. That's how we got started. We loaned ourselves money to the campaign. Had one fundraiser.
And how'd that go?
We had a golf tournament, raised a few dollars to get it started. It, quite frankly, didn't cost as much at that time as it does today.
Sure.
And I'll give you that story in a minute.
Okay.
We ran that campaign for less than $100,000.
Which is surprising, because that was just, 15, 16 years ago?
That's correct.
It's really not that long ago, but no. The cost of poker has changed so much.
It is. And we had some help. We had some other people, local people, that once we got in, that had been supporters throughout the years and all the other endeavors that I'd undertaken. So we were able to get some good financial backing from those people. The only thing that we do and still today, you know, this don't buy you anything. Because, I mean, you know, as I've said before, you may rent me, but you'll never own me because you can't buy me.
And you've said that before in this very room.
And that's where I am. And that's where I'm going to be. And that's where I've always been. And I think that serves me well.
Sure.
Serves my family well with that too. But today, and, you know, when I ran, I only ran two elections. I ran the first time. And then when I crossed over from the House after I was term limited out, I ran for the Senate. Mm-hmm. And then we had an election that was, but that's quite frankly one of the reasons that I'm probably not running today.
Sure.
It was just not a real friendly, it was an ugly race. Some outside forces outside this parish made it ugly, made it very cost prohibitive, you know. I think I was reading an article in this Livingston Parish News at that time, and close to $1 million race.
If I remember correctly. When I was doing research yesterday afternoon to kind of finish up how I wanted to flow through this with you, I went back and read some of my old articles from that time. And yes, it was a $1 million race. And that was, you know, for a state Senate seat, really for any race, that was unheard of.
Now I will tell you, I didn't spend but about a third of that.
Sure.
I couldn't afford it. And the people that supported me didn't want to do that. But anyway, make a long story short on that, we were able to win the race. And I certainly have enjoyed my 4 years in the Senate. But quite frankly, age is one thing. I think health-wise, I'm really in good health. You know, the doctors tell me I am. I don't think it's anything that. I just think that after 16 years I spent in the legislative body, that I think it was just time to move on. And as I said before, there's one other thing I want to do. And so, it 82 years of age, I think it's time to move on. But it's not because of. But I'm dissatisfied with the system. I think it's the best system we've got in this world. I'm glad to have the part be a part of it. I'm more than appreciative of the people who've given me that opportunity for 16 years to go and represent them. I only hope that I've done the best job that I can. I know, you know, I've said all along, when the end of the day, you may make 40 votes to get to the end of the vote, but the last vote that counts is one that people remember. And you either punch the red button or the green button. There's 50% going to like it. There's 50% not going to like it, generally. But you've got to go there. And I've done this, and I will tell you, and I hope that everybody that comes into these positions would take the same attitude that I have. And I think I'm right, that we are elected by the people, and we're there to represent their interests. I have made some votes that personally I would not make. Because the people that I represented, that's what they wanted. And that was in their best interest. And that's what I was there for. And that's why I made the vote.
You've made two statements to me over the years that have always stuck with me. And one is, during campaign season, you're going to have your proponents and your opponents. Mm. But when the election is over, they're all your people.
They are.
And that's who you represent. And the second one, as you and I have discussed, when you're talking about dealing with others at the legislature, and that's going to be the next series of questions, is that every bill has a proponent and they believe in it wholeheartedly. Now, whether that belief is from a social, political, ideological standpoint, it doesn't matter. They believe in it.
They believe in it.
And they want it. And so it makes dealing with that kind of scenario, it can be difficult.
Very.
So we're gonna talk about a couple of things you already mentioned, but first and foremost, you're running against four other people. You eventually come out the victor. You take the office in 08, right as Jindal's coming in, and you know you've had dealings with the legislature as the director of that group, as well as being a superintendent, I'd imagine.
That's correct.
What was it like to flip And so, suddenly you're walking in and now you're the guy.
It was an eye opener. You think that you know a little bit about it, and you know, and quite frankly, I knew a little bit more than a lot of us. We went in with 50 something new house members. Think about that. 50 something new ones.
That's
out
a lot of
105.
Turnover. Yeah.
And so we were all fumbling.
Well, now a lot of that's happening right now.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
You're seeing a lot of folks like you retire.
Yep.
A lot of people are termed out. You're going to see a lot. There was a lot of turnover during that 2019 election slate. There's going to be even more
this year.
Time around.
I agree. But anyway, it was an eye-opener for us. We went in and you think that you know a little bit, but it takes a while to get your feet on the ground. And I've said this, and I'll say it again. You just got to know which doors to open and which ones not to open, which ones to go through and which ones not to go through. Because there's really some great people that represent this state. There's some that probably, quite frankly, you would want to disassociate with.
Sure.
So you have to know that. But as you had said, everybody in every issue has a constituency. And you have to respect that constituency and respect their position. And it's a game of compromise. I know some people don't like that word, but in order to make progress, it has to be some compromise made. As long as you don't compromise your morals, integrity, you know, it's not illegal or immoral, then I think that if it's what your people want, then you need to do it. If it's in the best interest of who the people you represent.
Sure. And you know,
I know that's Pollyanna stuff, but that's just my belief.
And it, you know, for the most part, it's the way it has worked when we've run into this, I guess you can say political problem. And I'm sure a lot of people say, this is my opinion and that's fair. But the word you used was compromise, right? And what a lot of people don't seem to understand, especially at a federal level, if you go look at the demographics, for every one of you, there's one of them.
That's it.
And you got to learn how to work together if you want to get stuff done. Let's talk about some of the things that have gotten done and some of the things that you worked on while you were up at the state. You know, right now you actually see dirt moving on three things that have sort of been almost believe it when I see it kind of deals. You've got Jubin Road. Obviously, interstate intersection came during your time in the legislature. But getting the widening in the roundabout, Cook Road extension is actually happening, which is shocking. I mean, they've been talking about that since I was a kid. And also, the Komi River Diversion Canal they've actually dug out portions of that. So, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about as we've visited and done interviews over the years is the process. It's not sort of, it is. It's a process. Before we talk about how having those three actually become real makes you feel, I want to talk a little bit about, you've already brought up the word compromise, but I want to talk about the legislative process because these things take a while. What was the learning curve like that for you when you were having to, you know, suddenly it's like, oh, you mean I have to lobby this through? You know, maybe got to work with these folks on something. Then I'm going to get it on here. Well, maybe we'll have the funding. Maybe we won't. Then we have a couple more years, that kind of thing.
Well, you got to work with you got to figure out the committees. And there's 17, 18 different standing committees in each side, the House and the Senate. Each one of them have different roles. They're similar to something, but they're still things. To get a piece of legislation through, it takes a tremendous amount of effort. First off, you got to come up with the idea. Somebody has to come up with the idea. Then you got to draft the legislation.
Sure.
You have help. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But you got to oversee it. That legislation belongs to you. You have
right.
control of it until the final vote. You got to take it to committee. You got to convince the committee that this is something that not you just need, but the state needs, because it's a statewide issue, not just a local issue. Even though you're represented as a local issue, it's going to affect everybody in the state in some kind of way, potentially. So you got to convince that committee of doing that. Once it gets there, then you got to go to the floor of the House or the Senate, and you got to convince that body that it's in the best interest of not just you and the people you represent, but also for the state, which there's compromise there. Once that gets out, then you got to make sure that you've probably done enough with the administration, this time the governor, because he or she is going to get to either veto or sign that piece of legislation.
Right.
That's important, too.
Oh, yeah.
So once all that gets done, that's got to get signed. Once it gets signed into law, then it becomes a law, and then you move on from there. That's just one piece of legislation. Now, on an average day, if you go in, we'll have anywhere from 1,000, 1,200 pieces of legislation to deal with. Not all of it is yours. It's from either 105 House members or 39 senators, whichever the case may be. Once that gets out of the House or the Senate, then it goes to the other side of the aisle. If it comes from the House, it's going to the Senate. Same process has to start over there. You got to go to committee.
Right.
Senate get a senator to carry the bill for you, rah, rah, rah. If it's a Senate bill, it's got to come to the House. Then you go from there. But once all that takes place, then you hope you can get the funds for it, if in fact it's money. And everything hinges on money.
Sure.
And then you go and it goes through revenue and fisc. That's on the Senate side, or ways and means on the House side. One of the things that you brought up, and some of the projects we'll get back to in whatever, is that we have been very fortunate this last 4 years that I was able to lobby and get on to the Revenue and Fiscal Committee, which has to do with all capital outlay projects.
Which is a House Bill 2, usually. Senate Bill...
It's
House Bill 2.
House Bill 2, and we take it up on the Senate side.
Right.
We have a sitting House member that, Representative Mincy, was able to be a lobby and get on the Ways and Means Committee, mm-hmm. which is equivalent to the Revenue and Fisc.
Right.
So we work together very closely on these processes because it gets to go to both committees. So if we've got a capital outlay project, and it starts on the Senate side, he's got to work it on his side and vice versa. But we were able to do that. So what we would do is we would meet and decide with the different entities in the parish as to what we really need, what we want to do. Because you're not going to get everything. I mean, there's a million needs that we have in this parish. You just got to pick and choose which one you think is the most important, which one you got think that you've got the best chance to get in. So that's how we operated. And we did that for 4 years, and I think we're very successful because we were able to do some things. I tell you that I went back, and when they're on the House side, I had a senator that I worked very closely with the same way, and that's Senator Erdy. We worked very closely in capital outlay projects. If you go back and look, and you mentioned some of these, and I'd like to take the opportunity to mention these.
Oh, absolutely.
Interstate Highway. That was done not by me, but by our delegation. But it did happen during the time frame I was there, which is something that, it's been a big, I don't know what we would have done had we not extended the interstate to 6 lanes. I really don't.
Yeah.
Because we only got 3 basic ways to get across the Avent River. That's Magnolia Beach, and that's 190 and here, unless you go to Port Vincent.
Yeah.
I will tell you that we not only did the interstate, but we put new bridges while we were there across 190 and also at Magnolia, which was not only, it was needed. It was huge.
Yeah.
The project that you had mentioned out at Cook Road,
mm-hmm.
that was a process that started years ago and never could get all the fundings lined up. Once you got the funding, then there was other variables. Utilities, you had to appropriate the property, sometimes you had to expropriate the property. But anyway, you were able to get all that, Jubin Road. Why did it take so long for Jubin Road? It's two major issues. One, it took us for the utilities to be moved at 190 in there.
Mm-hmm.
We had the contract was supposed to be done in X number of days. It took 963 days to get the utilities moved, 3 years. The contractor that had it went belly up. We had to get bonding company to come in, get a new contractor. That delayed it for another year. So that's why that project has been delayed. But if you go by there now, you see movement, not just with a roundabout at 190 and Jubin. You see movement on Jubin itself. You see movement on Cook Road. And all that's going to tie in and make a huge, nice, big boulevard from 190 back to the interstate on Jubin Road.
Right.
One other project that we've got going that most people are not familiar with is to extend Jubin north, Jubin Road, north from 190 to Lockhart Crossing Road.
Right.
And that's going through the woods.
Right.
Money has been appropriated for that. Studies are going on. Everything has to be studied.
Right.
Environmental, that's just, people don't understand it. I don't understand it sometimes. We study to do studies, I think, sometimes. But environmental.
Plan to meet the plan.
Environmental has to be done. All these things has to be done, and that's been in the process now. So, but there's many things that's going on. We've got roundabouts going on. We've built roundabouts. We've got others coming. We've got another one coming at the end of Eden Church Road and Lockhart Road, which if you've traveled that road much, it's so dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
Highway 447 at Walker, you know,
mm-hmm.
that interstate.
The interstate
bridge,
interaction. And the bridge.
We've got funds lined out to widen that bridge and also to three lane or four lane back to Buddy Ellis Road. So there's things always going on. We got to put a roundabout where the hospital is in Walker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough turnout because if they're coming north from the south, you don't see them until they come around that corner.
It's just a tough time. So
yeah,
those are things. We've got a lot of projects going on. We've been working with the mayor here in Dumb Springs and Walker to see what we need to do with the interchange here at Dumb Springs. We know that's a bottleneck. But the DOTD, Department of Transportation and Development, is working with us on that. It's going to take some, and maybe some heartburn for some people for a while, but that's progress.
Yeah.
So
sometimes it takes a little
progress. I'm excited about where we're going, and I would hope that the next senator that comes in will work together with the representative and they'll see those projects through. That's my wish. I really do. Because if they can't get together and work on it, and I'd hate to say all the work that's been done through the years, it's late. I mean, because what you just said was absolutely true. It's a process. You don't do it. You don't walk in and say, I want this done, and it takes place tomorrow. Because everybody over there, there's 144 members in the legislature. Every one of them is fighting for the same dollar. Because they're taking, and they have needs back in their areas too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these committees, we have to make sure that everybody is represented in some kind of way.
Sure. And I mean,
it's a process.
It's a process, and it takes a little teamwork.
Teamwork. Compromise.
Yes. So as we wrap up here, I want to ask you two overarching questions. And the first one, we're going to stick with the legislature. And if you can't point to anything specific, I understand, but proudest moment from your time in the House and the Senate. Can you name one?
While I was in the House, probably the one that probably sticks out that I think has more effect, and this has to do with health care, because I was on Health and Welfare Committee for 16 years on both sides. But we helped the optometrists pass a bill that would give the rural areas an opportunity for those people to go in and have better optometry service by letting the optometry do some things that doctors didn't want to do. So we took on the doctor, and were able to be successful. And it was a huge challenge.
And see, eyes are so interesting because especially healthcare and insurance treats them like they're not part of your body.
But they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is huge. And we worked with a local agency here that, you know, they were interested in it, and we were able to do that. On the Senate side, I think the biggest thing we was doing is to help with teacher retirement.
Okay.
We did a couple of things on 2 years in a row to help change some of that, keep some things from happening. Sometimes the best thing you can do is to keep bad legislation from getting passed. Instead of getting, it's not always about what you pass, it's what you can keep from getting passed.
Sometimes you got to play defense.
Absolutely.
As a former athlete, you know, defense wins championships, right?
But I spent a lot of time, was never on education committee, but I spent a lot of time making sure that we protected that. And that was what we did a lot of time, protect it.
And mostly lately there's been a big push for things like voucher systems,
yes,
and charter schools and that sort of thing. But for a while there, it was just... really was defending the MFP, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Money. You always have, yeah. It's all about money. Absolutely.
So the second question, which is an overarching question throughout this whole interview, and you can feel free to disagree, but as we've sat here and talked, you know, and as I went back to make sure I had a lot of my facts about your life correct, you know, couple of things that I came up with was tenacious, a self-starter, but also... you were willing to keep your mind open. You're a lifelong learner. If you were to, this is the question, if you were to sort of give your success a foundation, I would imagine it would be those three principles.
That is correct. Yep, that is right.
So, you know, if you were talking to somebody, you know, I always like to posit this question. You enter the room with the kid that just graduated with a master's. What are you telling them based on those three principles, that foundation that you've built for yourself?
Well, to be true to yourself. Know that there's another being out there higher than you are. And I won't get into the religious aspect of it, but I think everybody has to have a higher being that they believe in. I do. You call it Christianity, you call it what you want. I am a Christian, by the way. And I just... put that out there, but
sure.
I would just tell them to be tenacious, always be true to yourself, be true to your family. Don't give up on your dream. Don't give up on what you try to do. You can do what you want to do if you set your mind to it. My family's been very supportive of me. People have been good to me, very supportive of me. But I also think that I've helped myself by knowing what I want to do and not taking no for an answer.
Sure.
And I think that's important. You just sometimes you get setbacks, but you got to take those setbacks and figure out another way to get around the boulder.
Sure. And I'll steal a quote from my late father. Heaven helps those that help themselves. You'll be surprised what kind of support you get when you push yourself.
Absolutely.
To do big things.
Absolutely.
So, thank you, sir.
Well,
it was, you know, a lot of these things I've known, but, you know, not, you put it all together, you take the time.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Let me just say, I thank you for giving me the time. I can only tell you that, you know, there's a lot of things I'm sure we left out, probably a lot of things that bored people, and I apologize for that, but I am very committed to what I do, and I'm committed to this parish, and I will always be committed to this parish to see it grow and prosper and whatever. And I would hope that people understand that what we have is important to keep.
Very important. It's an economic engine here. It's a massive employer. It draws a lot of new residents here, and you know that is, you know, growth is important, but you know the parish council's working on it, working on that responsible growth. So
I will end by saying this: be careful what you ask for; you might get it.
No, and that's very true as well. And, any comments on the race for your seat?
Well, I just hope that whoever it is that that they understand that the parish needs a good representative. I have an opinion. I'm not going to share it. You know, everybody knows who I'm supporting, because I think he is the one that is there, not to put anything on the other person. She, you know, is a good lady, whatever. But I'll go back and look at what's been done, who I've worked with, progresses we've been made, and I just hope that we can continue to do that, because the parish needs good people.
Yes, we do, as we move into these interesting times. So thank you, sir, again, for taking the time.
Appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me today, and I hope that it hadn't been too boring.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I'm sitting here on the edge of my seat the whole time. So if you'll want to reintroduce yourself real quick as we head on out of here.
Let me just say it's been a pleasure being here. I'm J. Rogers Pope. I'm a resident of Livingston Parish, lifelong resident of Livingston Parish. Former school person, still a school person, and will be shortly a former legislator, but we'll support legislation because I think it's the best system we've got going.
And possibly a teacher coming up here.
We'll be one
will
day.
Will be a teacher. There you go. There's
we'll
that tenacity. Will be a
we'll
teacher.
Will be.
So one last time, I know I keep saying it, but thank you, sir.
Thank you again. Thank you so much.
And my name is McHugh David, publisher and editor of the news. Appreciate you all out there for taking the time to listen today and joining us. Please remember the news is on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. There it is. We are once a week in print on Thursdays at $7 a month to get that in your mailbox. We're also online, www.livingstonparishnews.com. We appreciate you joining us, and we're going to see you next time.